Now, a defiant North Korea appears to be raising the stakes in its nuclear showdown with the U.S. and the rest of the world after its claim of a first successful test of an atomic weapon. Today, North Korea is threatening more such tests or even the firing of a nuclear-tipped missile unless the U.S. enters bilateral talks with North Korea. The Bush administration is rejecting direct talks, saying it will not be intimidated. Farrah Stockman is foreign affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. She joins us from Washington. And Farrah, remind us, why is it so important for North Korea to have direct talks with the U.S., and why is the Bush administration so opposed to that?
Thanks for having me. I think that the Bush administration has always looked at direct talks as a kind of reward. They really don't engage much with people they don't agree with, and so I think that North Korea, they would have wanted North Korea to come a lot closer to their position before agreeing to direct talks. North Korea is also kind of like the neglected stepchild. They always sort of act up when the U.S. is paying more attention to Iran, and I think they just really want the recognition of direct talks.
Right. Well, the U.N. Security Council is meeting again on this issue today, trying to hammer out proposed sanctions, which we hear may come as soon as the end of the week. The Bush administration pushing for more aggressive sanctions against North Korea, there are already some in place. Could you sketch those out for us, what's being called for?
Well, I think there's a menu of sanctions that John Bolton would like the world to look at and consider, one of which is the idea of interdicting ships coming in and looking at ships who are leaving North Korea to make sure that they're not carrying weapons of mass destruction. I think that's the greatest concern right now for the Bush administration. You heard the president talk about it yesterday.
We understand that's also why there's a move to cut off financial paths to the outside world so that they can't send the nuclear material out and get money in.
Yeah, they've actually, over the past year, already really worked to shut down financial networks associated with North Korea, and I think that that's North Korean anger over those moves has may have been part of why they decided to go ahead with this nuclear test.
Well, you mentioned, you know, further sanctions, and what about the fear that if further impoverished by these sanctions, the North Koreans will find a way to sell this technology to terrorists?
Well, in fact, North Korea has sold a lot of its technology. They sold missiles to Pakistan, and mm-hmm. it's believed that they expected uranium in return for that. I think that there is a danger that North Korea could try to sell this technology. But I think that right now the country is under some of the most strict sanctions in the world already, and it's unclear what further moves would do.
Because those sanctions didn't stop the test on Sunday night. Well, in the White House press question and answer session today, spokesperson Tony Snow took a lot of questions along the line of, well, the U.S. invaded Iraq, which didn't have weapons, so what now about North Korea? Let's listen to his answer.
We invaded a country that was directly involved in a war on terror, that was paying off terrorists, that was making direct threats. That was one thing. And we went ahead and we dealt with a terrorist threat. And frankly, the world is safer off without Saddam Hussein. At the same time that all this was going on, the United States was also working on the Korea problem. Having learned from the mistakes, or having learned from the inability of prior administration efforts to try to deal with the North Koreans, we thought, you know what, if we go it alone, we don't have the leverage. We need to come up with a much more practical way of trying to deal with a regime that sometimes does not seem to respond to rational incentives. And we have to find a way from every possible angle to look for a diplomatic solution to this problem.
Of course, the solution was to involve China, South Korea, Japan. But we're wondering, Farrah, how much is the Bush administration being asked about this that you're hearing quite a bit, that they didn't do enough to pay attention to North Korea, distracted perhaps by Iraq and even Iran?
I think you are hearing a lot of people come out and criticize Bush's North Korea policy. It's clear the issue has been on the back burner for the administration for a while. Even conservatives have accused Bush of, you know, outsourcing North Korea policy to China, relying on China to do everything. And I think you're going to hear a lot more of that. Bush really reversed what Clinton had done When he came to office, he didn't like the way Clinton dealt with North Korea, and I think we're seeing that his own policy has not had good results.
Yesterday, China used the strongest language ever to condemn North Korea, but is there a sense of whether or not they will be on board with the idea of sanctions? Some have speculated they had the most to lose because they do the most business with North Korea.
I think that's really a key question. What is China going to do? I think that's a major question. China has been very frustrated with North Korea. North Korean officials had refused to see senior Chinese officials. In recent months, China, I think, is getting increasingly frustrated, and that's a good thing. But on the other hand, China does not have identical interests as the United States. I don't think they would like to see the North Korean government fall. I think they have a lot of, erratic as Kim Jong-il is, I think China is still an ally, and nuclear weapons in the hands of North Koreans wouldn't be pointed at China. So I think we have to remember that.
And yet, as many Chinese officials have said, millions of North Korean refugees would be headed to China if the country were to fall. I mean, that's one of their concerns.
Sure. Both South Korea and China are afraid of, the failure of the government there to the point that the country falls apart. I think that would be a huge disaster. But the question is now whether this test lets them see that there might be worse things in the future to come if something isn't done.
Farah Stockman, foreign affairs correspondent for the Boston Globe. Farah, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the story that dominated Washington news last week, the congressional page scandal, continues to dominate the headlines and the airwaves today. House Speaker Dennis Hastert, who's under fire for saying he only recently learned about sexually explicit emails between ex-Congressman Mark Foley and teenaged former pages, said this morning that he would dismiss any member of his staff involved in a possible cover-up.
In 2020 hindsight, probably he could do everything a little bit better. But if there is a problem, if there was a cover-up, then we should find that out through the investigation process. They'll be under oath, and we'll find out. If they did cover something up, then they should not continue to have their jobs.
The House Ethics Committee is taking sworn testimony from Republican leaders this week. And today, the only openly gay Republican in Congress, Jim Colby of Arizona, confirmed media reports that he learned of inappropriate messages between Foley and One Page 6 years ago. But Colby denies reports that he was told that those emails were sexually explicit. Well, all of this is taking place as questions about the role of gay Republican staffers in the scandals arise. And as Washington is abuzz about a list circulating in the city of closeted gay conservatives. Well, we want to spend a few minutes today on the topic of the Republican divisions over gay issues. And joining us in line from Washington to do just that is Mark Leibovich, who writes for the New York Times and wrote about this on Sunday. Mark, welcome.
Hi, Robin. Good to be here.
You've been in Washington a long time. Have you ever seen anything quite like this?
No, it's fairly unique. I mean, this is A-list Washington scandal, but obviously there is a great deal of involvement by either openly gay or closeted gay Republicans who have for many years had a very, very somewhat innocuous, at least to the public, but also very, very, very powerful role within the party at the highest level of the staff ranks. And certainly this case is no different. I mean, Jeff Trendle, who was the clerk of the House, and Kirk Fordham, who was the chief of staff to Foley for many years, are openly gay. And, for better or for worse, a lot of conservatives have pointed to the coincidence of this as being part of the story.
Well, and you write that there's a broader story here. We'll get to the roles of Jeff Trendle and Kirk Fordham in a moment.
Right.
But you write that one of the open secrets of Washington is that so many Republican lawmakers have top staff members who are gay. In fact, some of them meet regularly. What do they call themselves?
There's one group that calls themselves the P Street Project, which is a group of about 10 Republican staffers who are gay, who meet around DuPont Circle usually, which is a heavily gay enclave of Washington D.C. And the P Street Project is a play on K Street Project, which is the Republican campaign to try to spread influence on K Street and the lobbying community. But yeah, this is something of a support group for gay Republicans. They get together once a month or so, and some would say that being a gay Republican is a contradiction in terms, and I think the fact that they would even call themselves a support group is telling in itself.
Well, support for what? Because, first of all, we should say this is quite separate from the Log Cabin Republicans. This
right.
is an activist group of lawmakers. You're right. talking about staffers who meet, and what do they do, commiserate?
Yeah, as far as I know, I mean, I've never actually attended one of these meetings, but, as a reporter, but it's very, from what I can tell, it's a fairly casual get together, and there are quite a few, problems unique, I guess, to being a gay Republican. I mean, I think a lot of gay Republicans will say that sometimes it's even harder to come out as a Republican to their gay friends as it is coming out as gay to their Republican friends. So,
but some would say instead of commiserating and meeting, privately,
right.
why not do something about it? It really does beg questions. Why are they even there?
Right.
If the policies, for instance, and it sounds as if what you're saying that some of the policies might make them uncomfortable.
Right. Oh, certainly. I mean, I think, that is a question they get all the time, which is, why on earth are you a Republican? The answer is, generally it comes in two parts. One, I'm firmly committed to the small government ethic of the Republican Party, and two, for as much as I am appalled by so much of the rhetoric you hear about, gays and lesbians within the Republican ranks sometimes, I'm committed to stay and fight and hopefully change the big tent of the party from within.
Well, we're coming up on a break. We're talking with Mark Leibovich of the New York Times. You have written that sometimes this group of staffers that meets calls themselves Pink Elephants or the Velvet Mafia. Brian Bennett, who's a gay Republican political consultant, former chief of staff to Bob Dornan, says that to assume there's some sort of gay mafia at work is noxious and homophobic. Give me your first thought, Mark, and then we'll take the break. We'll come back with more. But what do you think is happening in Washington, especially around the Mark Foley congressional case? Do you think that there was some sort of a agreement between gay top staffers to keep it quiet?
Right. Well, I certainly don't know that. I mean, I haven't heard it, and my reporting didn't lead me to it. But, certainly, I mean, I think the term gay or pink or the term Velvet Mafia or Pink Elephants, I mean, it's something of an insider slang. I mean, I don't think there's an actual organized network of staffers and, Republican lobbyists and administration officials who get together and plan an agenda and plan what to cover up and what to trump up and so forth. But, I actually think it's something of a harmless slang from within. I mean, I don't think it speaks to any, great organized effort by any stretch.
But as you know, others are saying just that. Mark Leibovich, a political correspondent for the New York Times in Washington, D.C., on the further fallout from the Mark Foley congressional page scandal and how it's, divided many Republicans and what impact that might have. We'll have more with Mark when we come back. Take a quick break. Much more coming up here and now. A conversation about gay Republicans in power in Congress, not maybe in the front of the law office, but as a top staffer for a lawmaker. And this is all in the wake of the Foley congressional page scandal. Our guest, Mark Leibovich, political correspondent for the New York Times in Washington, D.C. You might ask, why is this important? Well, some would say because these private lives become important when they implement public policy. And Mark, we were talking about, what exactly might have been happening in the wake of the Foley scandal. As you know, some conservative Republicans accusing gay staffers and others of possibly covering up the Foley story to protect fellow gay Republicans. But as you know, other top gay staffers say they tried to warn people about Mark Foley because they very much differentiate between a gay man and a predator, who, in fact, they say gives gay Republicans a bad name. Tell us who some of those are, some of the gay top staffers who said they did try to tell.
Well, I mean, certainly the two staffers at the center of this are Jeff Trandle, who is the clerk of the House, which is, probably, one of the top few most powerful unelected positions there is on Capitol Hill. I mean, he essentially, you know, for one thing, manages the Page program. And Trandall is openly gay and has been for years, and was one of the first to know about the Foley emails to the underage Page. And the other is Kirk Fordham, who was the longtime chief of staff for Foley. Recently went to work for Tom Reynolds, who is the a Republican congressman from around Buffalo, who is up for re-election. He's also chairman of the Republican congressional committee, and he, you know, had a very high role in this. He obviously knew about Foley's emails very, very early, and again, he has come under great criticism from within the Republican leadership for not being more forceful and alerting people about these emails, but he would say, he's now saying that a number of people close to Denny Hastert knew about it also. So, you know, certainly this will give fodder to those who believe that gays are being unfairly scapegoated within the Republican Party, and it will also give fodder on the other side for those who believe that, well, you know, there's some kind of secret, you know, cabal involved that is trying to cover up for one of their own.
And by the way, Kurt Fordham, once again, Foley's top aide and then top aide to Tom Reynolds of New York, who's since left that post as well, while he testifies before the Ethics Commission. He claims he told Dennis Hastert's top aide, Scott Palmer. Palmer says he has no recollection.
Right. No, I mean, Scott Palmer, I mean, I think that's one of the many points of contention in this story, and obviously the FBI is involved now, and there are thorough investigations, so I guess, you know, we all just have to wait and see you know, how it plays out.
Well, in the meantime, there is this list circulating in Washington, D.C. In fact, we hear it, or circulating on the Internet, I believe.
Yeah.
In fact, we hear it's called The List. We're not going to mention the names on it now. You haven't printed it, but who is this list from, and what's the intention?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's from a group of gay activists who have believed for years that it's okay to out people, and they, you know, put together a list of, I guess, about a dozen or so top staffers on the Hill, and are circulating it widely on the Internet and so forth. I mean, I actually haven't seen the list. I don't know who's on it. I have a pretty good idea of who might be on it, but it's not. You know, it's just, I think it speaks more to the sound and fury of the environment at this point than it does to actually, you know, any news value at this point.
Well,
so,
some people might say it's repugnant that someone's private life is at all discussed or exposed, but others, and some behind the list, are saying that there are rumors, and there have always been rumors, not very far off the radar in Washington,
sure,
D.C., that some very top Republicans are in key positions are gay, and they are responsible for the socially conservative message that President Bush and many Republicans have based their campaigns on, and that it's hypocrisy, you know, for someone to be living one lifestyle while condemning, and not just condemning, but forming legislation, you know, preventing others from living any kind of lifestyle.
Well, this is something, you know, these people hear, you know, charges of many, many, many times a day, especially these days. And I think, you know, that's maybe one of the reasons why the ranks of gay Republican staffers are so largely closeted, and even those who aren't closeted certainly do try to keep a low profile about their lifestyles, and much less so than you would find among their counterparts in the Democratic Party. So,
well, we know of a case, and you write about it, where a very conservative lawmaker, Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum, Congressman Senator Rick Santorum, comes to mind.
Right.
He equated homosexuality with bestiality, and then it was revealed that one of his top aides was gay. What did he do?
His top communications gay. His top communications guy is openly gay and has been for a number of years. It was not widely known on Capitol Hill, but certainly Robert Tranum is his name. He is, you know, he's a longtime aide to Senator Santorum. He's now a campaign, you know, top advisor to his reelection campaign. And, yeah, what happened was a few months after the Associated Press interview in which Santorum infuriated, you know, a number of people by equating homosexuality with bestiality and incest and any number of things. You know, Robert was outed by a gay rights activist on the Internet. He confirmed the report, and you know, eventually the Philadelphia Inquirer wrote about it, and, you know, Santorum made a statement in support of Robert, and, yeah, and Robert, you know, to this day is still one of Santorum's top and most loyal aides.
And this story exposes that once again, and I'm wondering, Mark Leibovich, in the minute or so we have left, what do you think is going to happen here? Some are saying that what's going on now is a witch hunt, others, and that it could lead to a Republican civil war. Others are saying it's finally shining a light on the hypocrisy behind the power brokers.
Right. Well, I think there's elements of both of that here. I mean, certainly this is something that has made a lot of gay Republicans nervous, not just for, you know, its political fallout, but also for the effect it can have on their lifestyle and their ability to, you know, to continue with the equilibrium they've reached, you know, in their own lives. And certainly this is not the most enjoyable environment to be a gay Republican in. And, you know, there are recriminations on both sides. And I think, you know, you're, at the very least, you're going to see a lot of these folks, you know, laying low until the story subsides.
Just a couple seconds left. How is it affecting the base, do you think, at all? Or
Well, you know, I see the same polls everyone else does. I mean, it certainly seems like, you know, it could have a very, very direct effect on the elections next month.
Mark Leibovich, political correspondent for The New York Times, speaking to us from Washington, D.C. Mark, thank you so much.
Great. Thanks, Ron.
Much more coming up here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from... and I'm going to read an email. See if you can guess who sent it. They are trying to crash our party, and we need to beat the expletive deleted out of them in front of all the other would-be party crashers who are standing on the front lawn waiting to see how we welcome these dirtbags. Is it a gangbanger? An insurgent in Iraq? No, it's Chris Doherty, the former director of the Bush administration's Jewel in the Crown education program, Reading First. The email surfaced as part of a recent investigation eviscerating the program for favoritism, cronyism, and conflict of interest. The Education Department's own inspector general found that DOE officials funneled millions of dollars in grant money to a select group of textbook publishers to the exclusion of others who were equally qualified to participate in the program. Michael Grunwald has been covering the story for The Washington Post. He joins us. Michael, start with an overview of what the Bush administration wanted to achieve with Reading First.
Well, Reading First was a billion-dollar-a-year program that's supposed to essentially get scientifically-based reading programs into public schools that really need it, really the No Child Left Behind, the neediest schools.
It was a mandate of the No Child Left Behind initiative that the textbooks be scientifically mandated.
Yeah, in fact, the phrase scientifically based research appeared more than 100 times in the No Child Left Behind law. What the inspector general showed is that the scientifically based research was not really the top priority for the people running Reading First.
And in that specific email, Chris Doherty, again then head of Reading First, was telling his staff to keep one of the textbook companies that was qualified out of the program.
Well, there are two ways to look at what's been going on in Reading First. For one thing, the people running the program were big phonics people, and the Bush administration, they're big supporters of phonics, which essentially involves the kind of rote instruction to teach kids how to sound out words. The other main philosophy is whole language, which involves more reading in context and understanding the meaning of the words as you're learning them. That's a legitimate debate that's going on in the education world. The Bush people are phonics people, and it's very clear from their emails that wherever there were whole language programs, they were really trying to stamp them out. They don't think it's scientifically based. When one whole language proponent ended up on one of the evaluation panels, they kind of said, well, we can't disinvite her, but make sure she's on the panel with one of our barracuda types. And they really were bragging to each other about how they were stamping out whole language programs. At one point, Chris Doherty said in an email about one of the programs where somebody had proposed that being their core program, he said, oh, yeah, when pigs fly. So that's certainly one of the debates going on.
Well, aside from, you know, whether this is the kind of language you want to hear from an education department official, what were some of the other findings of the report about possible abuses of the funding and the favoritism displayed by Reading First?
Well, even if it was absolutely clear that what the Reading First folks were doing was promoting the better programs as opposed to the worse programs, there were very strict requirements in the law against the federal government really endorsing certain programs, and it's very clear that the Reading First guys did. States would come up with their list. If it didn't include the sort of approved list, even though they said there was no approved list, it would get rejected, and they'd reject it again.
You give the example of Rhode Island when it had to apply how many times?
I think they had six. They were rejected six times, I believe, which again would be controversial, even if this was purely rejecting, you know, programs that did not seem scientifically based and promoting ones that did. Except that the phonics program that has the best record of scientifically proven success is a program called Success for All. And it has been almost entirely frozen out of Reading First. And that's where you start to say, you know, if it's just about phonics, why aren't they promoting some of these terrific phonics programs? And that's where you start to see some of these conflicts of interest, where the program was really put together by a kind of in-crowd of a few consultants who developed various programs, served on the committees that evaluated the programs, were constantly promoted as state consultants to tell states what to put on their list of the programs they want to use, and there was just a real kind of web of cross-cutting conflicts of interest that all sort of pointed back to the same handful of education consultants.
And some of these consultants had been DOE officials previously.
Some of them have kind of moved back and forth, and several of them were consultants to Secretary Rod Page when he was the head of the Education Department. After he left, he went to work for the guy who had sold Voyager Passport, which was a totally unknown program. The Voyager company had been appraised at about $5 million in a newspaper story before Reading First. Randy Best, the owner of it, sold it a couple years ago for $360 million. And then hired not only Secretary Page, but the architect of the Reading First program, a guy named Reed Lyon.
But Michael Grunwald, we remind ourselves that school districts who didn't want to go along with the process forfeited huge federal grants to keep their own reading programs, the ones that they felt were successful. But bottom line, did other schools who used Reading First, did they think Reading First worked?
That hasn't been decided yet. I have to say, since I wrote this story, I've gotten hundreds of emails from teachers complaining about how they were browbeaten into using this textbook or that textbook, but some saying that they really like Reading First. And let's face it, it's $1 billion a year for reading in low-income schools, and that's got to be helpful. The question is whether it's going to help as much as it can. So far, the department has already shown some evidence that schools that are using Reading First are devoting more time to reading.
And what happens now? Do companies like Success for All, are they going to sue the federal government because this report now shows that they were shut out of the process?
Well, several of them have already filed complaints even before this report came out. The new Secretary of Education, Margaret Spelling, has said that she is going to review every state application, that they're not happy about the way this was put together. But they have also defended Reading First very vigorously. They feel like it's working. They feel that even if the actual textbooks have not been scientifically proven, they feel like the basic phonics approach is proven to work. And they feel pretty good about going full steam ahead with this.
And Michael, having done this reporting, what are some of your thoughts?
No Child Left Behind really had three really revolutionary goals. And the first was the really No Child Left Behind idea, that we're going to bring up the lowest and focus on low-performing schools. And the second was the idea of bringing in this federal role in education, that you could have national standards. But then the third idea was this, the idea of bringing real facts and evidence into the, you know, the world of education, which has always kind of gone by gut. And I think there's a real fear that because of all these conflicts of interest, because of the ignoring of science and rigor, that it's going to endanger some of those first two goals. So that's one of the real concerns about the way this program has been mismanaged.
And we should say Chris Daugherty has left the program.
Yes. He resigned after these reports findings came out.
Michael Grunwald of The Washington Post covering the ongoing investigation into the Reading First program. And by the way, we should also note, Michael, the author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise. We'll have to talk to you down the road about that. Thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're listening to Here and Now. $100 million in 1915, $200 million in 1967. And get ready, because any day now, just 40 years later, will come the 300 millionth resident of the United States. Now, no one knows who this person will be or where he or she will appear, but that hasn't stopped some of the nation's top demographers, such as our next guest, from taking their best shot.
I think it's going to be a Latino baby born in Los Angeles County to a Mexican immigrant mother on October the 17th.
That's William Fry. He watches the population ebb and flow for the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. And let's go through your calculus as to what this person will be. An Hispanic?
Yes. Half of the growth of the population in any month or in any year currently is to Hispanics.
Well, now, this might not be a baby at all, though, because we understand that 60% of population growth is from new babies, but 40% comes from immigration. So it could come from an immigrant becoming a legal resident.
That's true. It could be anyone coming off of a plane as a new resident of the United States or crossing a border in Mexico or Canada. About a 4 in 10 chance it could be an immigrant.
And the fact that it might be that, or it might be an Hispanic, how does that shift or change, America as the population tilts more towards this person?
You know, I think what this 300 millionth new person will symbolize is a return to the kind of melting pot that we used to have in the United States. You know, for about this last half of the 20th century, we were very insular. We were very inward looking. We had a strong white suburban middle class population, and we were very much successful due to the post-war recovery, the post-war economy that we had in the United States. But now, as we turn to the new century, I think it's important for us to have this new melting pot population. And that's really what's happening because of immigration, because we have more people coming in from Asia and Latin America. Our younger population, as symbolized by this 300 millionth birth, is going to be much more global in its orientation.
You've also said more focused on marriage, on family.
That's right. They're much more traditional in their family orientation. And I don't say we're going to go back to the 50s where everybody was living in an Ozzie and Harriet family, but I think we're going to inch a little bit more toward that more traditional family model as we get more immigrants coming to the U.S.
But what kind of conflicts do you see appearing? I mean, we already have huge debates over immigration. So what do you see the conflicts being between newcomers and established Americans?
Well, I think some of the conflicts are geographic and some of them are generational. Geographically, for the very first time, we're seeing many more newcomers moving to the middle part of the country that haven't seen very many immigrants for a long time. So there's a little bit of a culture clash. And it's also generational. I mean, everyone over age 40 in the United States, mostly baby boomers and people older than baby boomers, grew up in an America that was mostly white middle class, grew up in an America that didn't have a lot of immigrants.
You say that you don't expect, even though there's a forecast that by 2050, Caucasians in the U.S. will become a minority in this country. You say you don't see that there will be as many racial conflicts as these regional conflicts.
Well, I think that's right. We're going to see much more of an openness towards people of different race and ethnic groups, especially among the younger generation. These people already are doing more interracial dating, more interracial marriage. And as we have more multiracial children become established in our country, the old ideas of strong racial and ethnic classifications as we know them today, I think will disappear in another 15 or 20 years.
Well, now, the number has just jumped so exponentially, as we said, from 1915 with 100 million. Now we're waiting for the 300 million. And when are we going to hit the 400th?
Well, that's estimated to be about 2043.
Is the U.S. ready to take on so many people in just 37 years?
You know, I think that it's much easier to project the population into the future than to project the kinds of technological innovations that we're going to uncover to be able to consume energy more efficiently, to be able to have a more managed land use pattern than we do now, to be able to think about how we're going to communicate with each other electronically rather than fly planes from one place to another to have business meetings. And I think all of that will play out in a way that will allow us to accept this 100 million additional people in the next 46 years, 36 years.
William Fry, demographer with the Brookings Institution, thanks very much.
Sure, I enjoyed it a lot.
And you can watch the countdown to the 300 millionth U.S. resident on the digital clock at the Census Bureau's website by going to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Mm-hmm. now. Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter beheaded by Islamic terrorists in Pakistan 4 years ago, would have turned 43 today. And tonight, HBO is premiering the documentary The Journalist and the Jihadi, which tracks the parallel lives of Pearl and Omar Sheikh, the British-born man who was convicted and sentenced to die for murdering him. The Journalist and the Jihadi begins with gut-wrenching images of 9/11 and narrator Christiane Amanpour describing how Daniel Pearl, already reporting from Asia, immediately responded.
Hours after the Twin Towers fell, he began tracking the story until he became part of it. This is the story of a passionate journalist and a shrewd terrorist, a reporter who happened to be Jewish and the Islamic Jihadi who set him up for slaughter.
But the documentary contends that a different man than Omar Sheikh may actually have killed Pearl, and that man is alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who's now being held in U.S. custody. We recently spoke with Ahmad Jamal, the co-director and producer of The Journalist and Jihadi. I asked him what Omar Sheikh, who's appealing his conviction, has been saying from prison about his involvement in the kidnapping and murder.
Well, in his interviews and his interrogation, he said, yes, I was responsible for kidnapping Daniel, entrapment. But we even say in our film that he sent a message, coded message, after about a week saying, take the patient to the doctor, which was a coded message for saying, let Daniel go. And the reply came that, you know, we've done the post-mortem, which means that he's been killed. Mm. So in our film, it's made clear that although he was responsible for the kidnap and all the planning, it was done through a different militant group, and somewhere along the line, he lost control.
Well, if Omar Sheikh is released because of this new information, your film points out it won't be the first time he's gotten out of prison after a kidnapping. But before we get to that, let's go back. Take us through these two intersecting lives. We know Daniel Pearl grew up in a loving Jewish family. He became a reporter after being a musician. You tell us that Omar Sheikh attended top-notch schools in London, but was one of the young Muslims who traveled to Bosnia in the 1990s, where he witnessed what he called the ethnic cleansing of Muslims as the West stood by. You spoke informally with some members of Omar Sheikh's family. Did you get any sense why he chose this path?
Well, he himself says that Bosnia was the turning point in his life. He decided to go to Pakistan and get training. And he was advised, according to him, by one of the Arabs that you should go and fight your own jihad in your own country because there's a war going on in Kashmir.
And the disputed territory between India and Pakistan.
Which he is, he's of Kashmiri origin, basically. And he was recruited by, as we say, a kind of a very militant Kashmiri group, Harkatul Mujahideen, and he went into India.
Jumping ahead, he becomes a kidnap specialist. He takes hostages. He, Omar Sheikh, ends up in jail in India. But then he himself is released from Indian jail. Why didn't someone follow him? Why, you know, and that's where one starts to ask, do you think the Pakistani officials were protecting someone like Omar Sheikh?
Well, the thing is that they were openly roaming around in Pakistan. They were not washed or arrested.
This is Omar Sheikh.
Omar Sheikh and Masood Azhar, one of the leading militants of that group. A lot of militant groups had links with the intelligence sources. But 9/11 changed all that. And I think President Musharraf decided that it's in the interest of Pakistan to break those links and decided to back the United States in taking on the Taliban. But when that happened, there were a lot of loose ends, a lot of people, you know, it's like hundreds of people, maybe thousands of operatives who had different allegiances.
Well, into this world comes Daniel Pearl and his wife Marianne after 9/11. They're trying to follow the money to find out if the Pakistan government is funding terrorists. What happens?
In comes Omar Sheikh, who's extremely manipulative. He's a chess player. He's supposed to be a very clever guy. And as Danny's looking for radicals to meet in Pakistan, he was a perfect target for them to try and grab him to make a point.
Because he represented Wall Street, but also maybe because he was too hot on their trail, or no?
Well, I don't know. It's just the atmosphere of the time. You know, the Americans had just started the offensive against the Taliban. A lot of people had been killed. There were bombings, and there was a sense of outrage amongst the people who sort of ran Afghanistan, and a lot of them had come into Pakistan. And they thought that they would use Danny, you know, to make whatever the political demands they wanted to make.
As a filmmaker, you paint the two men as their lives intersect in a radically different way, some would say an appropriately different way. Daniel Pearl, you know, there's lovely, poignant music as we meet his parents, his sister. We see these home videos of him as a young boy. Omar Sheikh, ominous music as we, you know, see their lives almost intersecting. You're, as I understand it, a British of Pakistani origin and a Muslim.
That's right, yeah.
Which man were you drawn to try to understand more?
Well, I was tracking the story of Omar Sheikh even before this incident through a friend of mine, and we had made a proposal in 1999 to Channel 4 to do a film on Omar Sheikh. Yeah. But, you know, before 9/11, there was a kind of lack of interest in the Islamic world as such. And 9/11 suddenly brought it back home, that the world is too small for us to ignore any part of the world. It's too dangerous to be indifferent.
As you got to know Daniel Pearl, you already had, Omar Sheikh was already a subject for you, but as you got to know Daniel Pearl, what image did you form of him? What did you think of him?
Well, I think that the world needs is more people like Daniel Pearl, despite the risks involved, because he was one person who took the step of trying to understand the other side. And I think that kind of attempt to try and bridge the world, try and understand the Islamic world, different points of views, is maybe not possible right now.
You make a major decision in the film not to show the beheading of Daniel Pearl, even though it's available on the Internet. By the way, thank you. But was there debate over that?
Well, in my mind, there wasn't a debate, because one of the conditions of Marion Pearl to take part in the film was that we would not show the beheading. And I had no problem with that, because I said, if we show the beheading, we are doing what the guys, the murderers, did. They wanted to use that as their propaganda. If we showed that, we are conveying their message, the message of terror, of brutality.
Ahmed Jamal, co-director and producer of the documentary The Journalist and the Jihadi, which premieres on HBO tonight. And this note of caution about a disturbing image that is shown in the film, in the opening sequence. It's a brief video clip of a man jumping from the towers on 9/11. I asked director Ahmed Jamal about using that image, which most American media hesitates to show. Here's what he had to say.
When I saw it in New York, at the Tribeca Film Festival, the body falling on the big screen, I said, my God, you know, because I was in New York, but while I was in London, it didn't seem, you know, it seemed like a small speck, something falling on TV, you'd hardly notice it. But for New Yorkers and for Americans, I think it has a special significance. But we then discussed this afterwards, and we felt that maybe the time, you know, to let it stay, because that was in the footage of what was being said at that time.
Ahmed Jamal also told us this man has come to be known as the Falling Man. And the Falling Man is also the title of a recent British television documentary, which speculates that that man was Jonathan Briley, a sound engineer who worked at the Windows on the World restaurant. Well, we wanted to give you this information, to give you the option to look away when that image flashes by in the film. But Briley's sister Gwendolyn has said, whoever this man is, he was someone's son, someone's husband, someone's friend. We don't do him an injustice by looking at his picture. We honor him by it. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next.